ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National.
Very suave, erudite kind of guy.
We're here to surprise, delight, and maybe enrage you from time to time. We go where our curiosity leads.
Let's talk crazy. Let's act crazy. Let's be crazy, because then the enemy doesn't know what you're thinking.
Late Night Live, four new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
A massive explosion in Bali.
We are very concerned that Australians will be amongst those casualties.
Earthquakes have created massive tidal waves across Southeast Asia.
Killed in Indonesia's Aceh province after an initial quake off the island of...
Australian officials are already overstretched.
For the first time ever, Indonesia is entering a security agreement with another country.
Ratifying a major security treaty with Indonesia.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese met with the Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto to finalise the agreement.
Our biggest near neighbour is changing before our very eyes. By the middle of this century, Indonesia is forecast to be the world's fourth largest economy. Imagine that.
Before, we just handwriting. Now we change to the high tech.
A lot of interesting things happens in Indonesia, right? It's a fast growth for economic, especially in the trade.
Hamish has been in Indonesia, gathering a treasure trove of interviews for Global Roaming.
Geraldine, how lucky are we to have this big neighbour, which is for the most part democratic, peaceful, growing, which does seem to want to be our friend, but which is interesting and fascinating and dynamic. That, for me, is the thing, the allure of the Indonesia story.
It's getting better. We move forward about the economic changes.
The youth is ready. We are ready.
Are we changing a lot about the economic and the government?
Very eager to have globalisation.
We're taking you to Jakarta for the next in our mini-series, unravelling some of the mysteries of a nation right on our doorstep about which we know so little.
It's Hamish here in Jakarta.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, and this is Indonesia Rising from Global Roaming. So, Hamish, what are we looking at in this particular episode, episode two of our mini-series?
Obviously, we're making a big effort to explore the big, exciting things that are happening in Indonesia today and the trajectory that it might be on. But in many ways, I think we can't go past the fact that Indonesia is at a bit of a junction, and it's not entirely clear which way it is heading. And in part, that's because of the man that they've elected as the president, President Prabowo, who is himself a former military man. He was the son-in-law of Suharto, the dictator. And he brings to this role both a different attitude and personality, but very clearly some different features and different approaches to democratic process itself. And there are some worrying signs, Jerry.
Well, indeed, strange enough, while you were up in Indonesia, Duncan Graham, who was a man I worked with many years ago in Perth, who lives in Indonesia now, wrote a piece in that online outlet, Pearls and Irritations, which really did trouble me. And he talked, which I know there's a particular incident that we're going to talk about, but this statistic really did get me. According to Kompas, the nation's leading daily, the shadow of the military's return to dominance in civilian governance is now increasingly apparent. A total of 2,500 active TNI, that's Indonesian military, personnel, have quietly taken up civilian positions, a figure that exceeds the limits set by law. And I thought, wow, what's all that about?
Look, the big story that a lot of people were talking to me about while I was there was this acid attack that took place against a well-known human rights activist. And what emerged quite quickly was that it was two military intelligence officers that had carried out that attack. And I think that set a lot of alarm bells ringing. And subsequent to that, some of the media received takedown notices from members of the Prabowo government. And that's pretty worrying. A lot of the journalists that I met, I conducted a couple of talks, public talks there I was hearing from a lot of members of the media, look, we're worried about what's going on. We're getting calls from the various offices in government telling us to take down articles. Now, this isn't a country...
So that's straight out censorship and interference with the media.
Yeah, I guess that's what they were saying to me and really saying this is a departure from the two presidents' past. Obviously, towards the end of Jokowi's time, I think there were some worrying signs, but certainly bigger changes under Prabowo. Don't forget, he paraded his cabinet in military fatigues early on. There's also been these big changes to the penal code. The Dutch penal code's been replaced, as it were, with some pretty conservative legislation.
Well, these are those bylaws, which really do crack down on what you might call modern expression.
Like premarital sex, for example. But there's also a rewriting of Indonesia's formal national history, which we're going to get to in some of the subsequent episodes. Some say this is really an attempt to kind of wipe out some of the worst actions of the New Order regime, which, of course, was the regime of his former father-in-law. And some of the accusations of that time are leveled directly against Prabowo because of his role in the military and possibly in some of those disappearances. But also the recognition of Suharto recently as a national hero. You know, a lot of people have said that is a particular sign about the way Prabowo wants to interpret that period of history.
Just before we leave that extraordinary incident with the acid, which has happened before in Indonesian life, that's just typical sort of rivalry, is it, between the police and the military? Like, is that what that comes down to?
To be honest, I don't know what underpins it or what the factional side of it is. But certainly the reporting of it and then the censorship of that reporting, I think, is being seen as perhaps a signal of what Prabowo intends. And I think that's why our guest on this episode is so fascinating, because you're about to meet a member of Prabowo's cabinet. Her name is Mutia Hafid. In many ways, she breaks so many of the stereotypes of an Indonesian leader, young, female. She was actually a journalist for Metro TV, one of the big commercial rolling TV stations before entering parliament. But she had an extraordinary life story. She was actually kidnapped by militants in Iraq and then wrote a book about that. She entered parliament, ended up on the defence committee. That's how she got to know Prabowo. And I sat down with her in Jakarta. Minister, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Welcome to COMDG.
Thank you very much.
The Ministry of Communication and Digital Affairs.
A little bit about you, because I guess maybe Australian listeners might be surprised to learn that you studied in Australia at UNSW.
I did.
What was it like? When was it? This was sort of the end of the Suharto era, I think.
I came to Australia in 96. I graduated 2000. I started with a foundation studies at University of New South Wales as well. I did manufacturing engineering. It was an experience that I will never forget. Sydney is now my second home. I feel very, you know, it's as a student during that age, studying abroad in a challenging time in Indonesia is, of course, quite an experience. And at the same time, the economic crisis hit. I had to work for survivals in Australia to pay for the rest of my tuition, because I was actually under Mr. Habibie's scholarship at that time. So the scholarship was stopped on my second year, and I had to really work hard to finish the 4 year of university studies because manufacturing takes 4 years. But I did manage, and in fact, I got a lot of, exciting experience being a part-time worker in many places.
I understand you worked at Oporto, the chicken shop.
I did. Oporto is still there, yes.
Oporto is very much still there. That time also coincided with everything that happened in East Timor.
Indeed.
Australians asking you about what's going on at home. Am I right in thinking also that it was the fall of the Suharto regime that triggered something in you in terms of becoming a journalist, you know, watching
That's
it
right.
from afar?
Yeah, yeah.
What was that like? What did it do to you?
We have to remember that during that time, the internet is nothing like today. So really, I looked at what happened in my country through Australian press. And then also the first time I hear about the fall of President Suharto was also from Australian press.
Okay. Do you remember what, like the newspaper? Were you watching the ABC?
We were watching TV together with other Indonesian students, I remember. It was like nothing like we had imagined before. It was a fall that none have, you know, predicted, especially perhaps because we were away, not in the country. We're not seeing the development day by day, so it was a surprise for us. Even we wanted to have a mass demonstration at that time, Indonesian students in the Consulate General. And when we were still, you know, consolidating, Suharto already fell. Because the internet was...
But as a young person, you were swept up in that moment.
Yeah. That was, I think, another big moment that I had when I was in Australia, and also having to answer my fellow Australian friends about what's happening in Indonesia and what's happening in East Timor, for example, because it also happened during my time in Australia. It wasn't easy, and I was, to be honest, you know, Indonesians are not really used to speak openly. And Australians at that time, I think they're very critical. They're asking very critical questions because in Indonesia, we're not used to, you know, answer those questions. They're very open. But again, I learned that, you know, being open, that means you are being good friends. I realized that I should, you know, really be following more about what happened in my country. And that's when I decided that when I come back, I want to be a journalist.
And you've ended up as a minister in Prabowo's government. How do you describe Indonesia today? Because it's changing very rapidly. Jakarta feels very different. I know.
What do you mean?
Well, it's probably 15 years since I've been here. It's a much more modern city.
It's a more modernized city with lots of, now it's become a very center of economic for Indonesia. And you know that we are planning to move the capital city to Kalimantan. Mm.
That's still happening?
Yes, it's still happening. It is still happening.
In terms of Australians understanding what's happening here today, how do you, like, fast-growing economy, you know, unevenly spread, obviously, you know, the growth is not universal, cultural change, social change. How do you paint a picture of Indonesia today?
Let's start with the trying to make economy more just for everybody in Indonesia. Indonesia is such a big country with 280 million people. Prabowo was pointing that out as well. And that's why he has his national cooperative programs in each villages in Indonesia. And also, we call it Sekolah Rakyat, which is the school for the people to target those people who have not been able to access schools, hundreds of such schools being established within 1 year, and a lot others to really try to level to make it equal for people in terms of access of education and access of economy.
Free meals, lunchtime meals, you know, this is a big policy. I assume that's part of that as well.
Yeah.
Can all of this happen at the same time as building all the infrastructure, the roads, the digitization of the economy? Like, can Indonesia deliver it all at once?
The key is putting priority to what you think is the most important for the people. You can see the priorities within our national budget. So one of the highest is, of course, the education, and then free meal, and then defense, as we are trying to level up our defense spending according to, you know, our friendly neighbors as well. Because, you know, before, when I was still the chairman of the defense committee, it was only 0.98% of our GDP. Much, much, much lower for a country as big as Indonesia. I think that's not, you know, this is just not enough. So he's in... It's been increased, I think now about 1.3% of GDP, but a lot to go. He has been pointing out about the possible conflicts that we are seeing today years ago. when we were at the committee, and he was a defense minister. And it happened now. So he has been warning us as defense minister. And I think that's also one of his, I believe that's also one of his top priorities as well. Mm.
Do you think in the future we're going to see Indonesia a lot more engaged on the global stage? Because I guess
from, we are already seeing that. From
the outside, that's something that does seem distinct about Prabowo, right? That he wants to get involved. He wants a seat at the table.
Yeah.
You know, all the forecasts are a much wealthier Indonesia, you know, over the next couple of decades, and with wealth comes more influence. Is that, do you think, what we should expect from Indonesia in the future?
One of the things that you can expect, yes.
Hmm. It's Geraldine here, and you're listening to Global Roaming from Radio National. On this episode, Indonesia's Communications Minister, Mucah Hafid. And still to come, we'll explore whether she believes democracy is under threat now that President Prabowo is in charge.
Talk to me about the social media ban, because you've introduced this here.
Yeah.
A much bigger population, very social media engaged. Mm-hmm. How is the rollout going? Because it's faced challenges in Australia.
Yeah.
Is it facing challenges here too?
We have to be honest that we do compare notes a lot with our Australian counterparts, with Madam Anika as the communication minister there. And also Tony Burke was also here to also share the story. And we did it in our regulations. We did have a lot in common with Australian Act as well on social media ban. The rollout has been, of course, challenging, as I believe it was also challenging in Australia.
But challenging because the tech company is not complying, or?
They are now, the right words are, partial compliance at the moment, but we are working on it. So just last 2 days, Meta and Google was here for the, the summoning, because they've been called for investigation on the compliance. It was a long hours, but we hope that one or 2 days there will be some change of approach from the big platforms in terms of compliance. We actually got one already, but I have not made a public statement, but I think there will be more compliance within 1-2 days.
Indonesia relies on technology in a way that I think probably would blow the mind of many young Australians. Mm-hmm. Were there sort of additional layers of risk in introducing a ban here, given that?
Surprisingly, Hamish, it was an almost majority approval. It was more than 80%, and mostly mothers, some children. I do not say that children are against this, because there are children who are also very supportive of this. Teachers.
I suppose what I'm asking, though, is, you know, for a lot of people in the far reaches of this archipelago, technology might actually be a way of binding them to the national project, you know, to including them, given that they live very far away from Jakarta or Java.
Well, they will still be included. It's just that the ban is for the kids, for the children to have their accounts. But when digitalization is introduced in schools, it's still allowed. Even one of the program of Mr. Prabowo, our president, is to have a digitalized education in schools in remote areas, so they can get access from teachers, top teachers in Jakarta, and be able to listen by children in Papua, in North Sumatra, in Aceh. So that is one of his also programs. So again, people should not mistaken this as, you know, that means that children will not have access to digital in other parts of Indonesia.
Yeah. Do you think that ultimately, like, the tech companies are going to continue fighting countries like Indonesia and Australia on this? Do you think it's a losing battle, or do you think that sovereign nations like Australia and Indonesia can actually have their way against these tech companies?
Not at all. It's starting and it's been exciting. I think what we see almost impossible to be done earlier, it's actually happening now. With Indonesia case, X has already announced 16-year-olds, so they already changed their community guidelines. Some other will follow soon. That is a first major step, and then implementation will, again, you know, I must admit that it's going to be challenging. It's not easy, especially for Indonesia with 70 million children under 16. Mm.
70 million under 16?
70 million children under 16. So it's huge. And we know that even in Australia, it's challenging. So we will expect that it's going to be more challenging in Indonesia because of the size. And of course, size meant, you know, the complexities technically, but also economically, it's gonna be, you know, it's not, they're not gonna give up too easily. But again, we see changes in terms of the attitudes of the global platforms, in terms of communicating with governments, compliance level, in terms of the spirit of protecting children. So some actually have already, I think X has been actively already taking down accounts for under 16,
I suppose one of the big things I have noticed that is different about Indonesia is just how far the technology has sort of woven into society and the way the economy functions, whether it's WhatsApp or payment platforms. Can you describe for Australians maybe that haven't been here in a while, like, do you think Indonesia has sort of leapfrogged other countries in terms of digital take-up?
It's interesting that our adaptivity level by the people is very high in terms of all in digital sectors, including AI.
Yeah.
So people in Indonesia, they love to embrace technology. You were right, in terms of engagement, it's very high. And even for internet users, I think here is one of the biggest, spending of time in terms of 1 day, 8 hours in 1 day, average. That's the average. So
wow.
Young ones, they'll use more than 10 hours, I suspect. So that's how much we are engaged with. And again...
That can't be a good thing.
That's not a good thing at all, Hamish. And that's why I think delaying... And that comes from habits.
Yeah.
So when, since young, you introduce digital without, you know, the same amount of level and same amount of speed... digital literacy, then you will have a problem of addiction. So, yeah, if today we are facing 8 hours per day as an average, if we don't, you know, intervene with this, maybe within 1-2 years, we'll have 10 hours per day, and then it will just get more and more. You just have to intervene the addiction since they're children.
Okay, do you know what your screen time is?
As a communication and digital minister, my screen time is, I think, about a lot, maybe 10 hours per day. I have to monitor a lot.
Part of the job, is it?
Yeah. But I'm trying to lower down. I try to, you know, spend time with my bicycle and then my yoga just to, you know, balance.
Yeah.
Just to balance, yeah.
Tell me, there's a lot of ambition in Indonesia. Tell me, do you think Indonesia will meet the, you know, all of the forecasts of a, you know, top four economy, you know, high income status? Do you think it will actually deliver on the promise?
I'm the communication and digital minister. I should say yes. Not only because of that, though, Hamish, because I do believe so.
Hmm.
I do believe so. What might come in the middle, perhaps, in terms of our effort towards that goal, is the geopolitical situations of the world. So unless the war stops, then we might have a problem in reaching that goal. But we do believe that, you know, countries will soon resolve the conflicts, hopefully, to make it easier for other countries also to reach their own predicted goals. But with Indonesia being one of the largest population in the world, highly digitalized as well, with a lot of resources, it's very probable that we will reach the target that President Prabowo has said.
Yeah. Does it
and, sorry, not only President Prabowo has said, it's the predictions of the, you know, some organizations have predicted that Indonesia will reach the fourth biggest.
And do you think democracy will always be present in Indonesia? Is that certain?
Democracy?
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. We'll have elections. We'll have the press freedom. People, I think Indonesia is one of the places if you want to share many things on social media, we're quite free.
Yeah.
Some people might disagree.
Yeah. So, I mean, people say, look, it's not certain. It's not all guaranteed.
Yeah, but I'm challenging everyone just to open our social media and see, you know, critics about governments, not every day, minutes by minutes, but discussions about, you know, politics is also something that very Indonesian-like. Like, we love to talk about politics a lot in our social media, and it becomes just, you know, a customary thing that people talk about politics. It's not hate speech. It's just people like to, you know, discuss about politics a lot in Indonesia. And we're open, and as you can see in our social media.
Mucha Hafid, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Geraldine, your impressions?
Oh, look, there are two things. Those amazing statistics about how much people are online and for how many hours, including herself. But just that other lovely little observation she made, the comparisons between Australian life, if I had heard her correctly, where people did say things out loud. They analysed their own community and said things. And she realised when she went back to Indonesia that so much was quietly observed but never said out loud, and how much she had changed. Gee, I thought that was beautifully put.
I thought it was really interesting to hear her, given that earlier episode we'd done with Damien Cave about Australian education being offered to Asian students and so many returning home unhappy. So many of those leaders, whether in business or politics in Indonesia today that I met, had been educated here in Australia. And like Mucha Hafid said, it was an amazing experience that shaped them. I think it's really worth us considering how powerful that tool is for us in terms of shaping the people that go on to lead our Asian neighbours.
Well, this, of course, is what the universities constantly say. And I think it's fair to say that their arguments sort of land on deaf ears in various governments.
But worth remembering who you might be dealing with when you go to the chicken shop.
Couldn't agree more with you. I absolutely do. And I think this, you know, the soft power advantage, I mean, there's a lot of other things, but that is involved in that interplay is crucially important. Of course, huge numbers of Malaysian students here too. They're the biggest number of all. Now, what do we have coming up in this mini-series, Hamish?
So we're going to meet the historian David Van Reybroek. He's written this book, Revolusi, which has been recommended by
several times.
Of guests, including William Dalrymple. I'm going to recommend it this week as a companion to this mini-series. If you want to really dive into Indonesia, he asks a big question of you, even if you think you know Indonesia's pathway to independence. He's essentially inviting you to come at it again, and I'm really looking forward to sharing that conversation. We're also going to touch base with the author Laxmi Pamunchak and explore sort of cultural memory and how Indonesia sees itself today. You'll meet the CEO who built Jakarta's metro in the coming weeks. And one for you, Jerry, I'm very excited that we've got a senior serving Australian diplomat, the current Australian ambassador to Jakarta,
Excellent.
Rob Brazier.
Excellent. Does he enjoy his life there, do you think?
Certainly does. He's a passionate diplomat, but a real Indonesia expert. And I think you'll be impressed with the way Australia is, I suppose, representing itself on the global stage.
Looking forward. Well done, Hamish. Thanks very much indeed.
See you next time.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.